You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is the CRM Archaeology Podcast. It's the show where we pull back the veil of cultural resources management, archaeology, and discuss the issues that everyone is concerned about. Welcome to the podcast.
Welcome to CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode
321.
And today I am joined by Bill up in Northern California.
Good morning.
And Andrew in Southern California.
Hey guys, how's it going?
And today we are honored to have a guest co-host, Renee Collins. And Renee, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure thing. What's up, everyone? My name's Renee. I am a cultural resource specialist and tribal liaison at Bahr Engineering. I specialize in, obviously, the tribal bit, and I specialize in the Intermountain West of archaeology.
Cool. And where are you out of? What state?
I'm currently out of Montrose, Colorado.
Great. Okay. Where is Montrose, Colorado?
It is on the western slope. The nearest town you might know is Grand Junction.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Oh, right. Cool. Yeah.
Awesome. My grandmother taught at a one-room schoolhouse in Grand Junction back in the early 1930s.
Which that's is awesome. Kind of cool.
Wow. Yeah. That's pretty crazy.
Yeah. All right. Well, today we had a listener who suggested an idea. His name is, he goes by Vitruvius, and his suggestion for a topic is idea for an episode, the impact of the governmental shutdown for archaeology, how it impacts private, public, academic archaeology, repositories, museums, permits, oversight, data access, and so on. So we thought before this furlough is over, because our fingers are crossed it will be over very shortly, and hopefully even before this episode airs, we thought we would talk about this topic. And so furloughs. Yeah. Who wants to start?
I mean, I guess I can start. So from my, like where I'm speaking right now here, November 2025, the university system has already been getting slammed by stuff that's going on in the national government. So the defunding of certain programs, the, you know, I guess ransoming of compliance from a lot of universities, vanishing students. I mean, this 2025 has already been a rocky year for academia. And, you know, the government shutdowns are also adding to the problem. And I've got, you know, some things that are positive that are happening. So there's some individuals in my department and at the university that originally had their federal funding revoked. Then after many months of getting sued and saying that, you know, you already allocated the funds, the grants are already open, a whole bunch of different protests have ended up in the situation where they got their funds returned only for the federal agency administrators and the people who are supposed to help these projects go forward are no longer working, right? So, you know, from our side, it's a success in that we got the funding to do the research and we're able to save a lot of our programs and research labs. But on the other hand, now there's no one to help administer the funds. And so, like, when you're coming from academia, it's a really complicated, convoluted system at some of these bigger schools with regard to these federal grants and federal fellowships and stuff like that. And that there's no set aside specific location where the money's coming from. And I'm one of those people who worked in CRM long enough to know that show me the money is the mantra, right? Like, it's great for you to tell me that I've been awarded the cash, but it doesn't exist until it shows up in my account in the university. That's when we actually have money to do research. So when money is allocated to universities, it's kind of interesting because the university, like, I don't know where it all actually goes. I don't think really anyone does. That's why they want it that way. The grant comes from the agency that's getting its funding from the different department of the government that has set aside the funds for this research purpose, right? You win the grant, and then it's like magically transformed into this black box at the university where it goes into a bunch of different envelopes that the university does a million different things with. You know, it can borrow against your funds to do all kinds of different stuff. It can, you know, create bonds, specifically calling your funds as one of the assets that the university has that makes them a safe bet for Wall Street to, you know, buy, you know, municipal bonds about the university. And some of it actually goes to you doing the research, right? So it goes into these accounts to show, you know, that the university has assets. Part of those are your assets, but it's doled out slowly over time to you through your account, right? So you file all your invoices and everything, just like a regular CRM contract with your own university. And then that money is doled out to your people. So it's like, it shows that it exists in the university under an account. And then you file all your stuff as you use money, as you hire students, as you hire postdocs, as you know, go and do the research, then you're like, you have to reimburse yourself from your own funds to get that cash. Or in the case of paying students, it comes from a certain account at the university and goes into that student's account, right? So the key piece of it is making sure that you're making these benchmarks and that you're in communication with the agency, because there's an administrator on their side who is asking the university, so how is it? I want to hear an accounting of this fund. What did they do with it? Did they actually do that stuff, or did they, you know, buy a new Lamborghini and escape off into the distance, right? They want to know what's happening with those funds. Well, that's the piece that's missing. And without that accounting piece on the other side, or you making those meetings with that agency person, or you having your, you know, periodic progress reports read by someone, I mean, it's put you in a dangerous situation, right? You've gotten the funds back, and maybe you've gotten the notice to proceed, but if you haven't, then you've just got funds sitting there, and you've got students who need to get paid that you're like assuming that it's okay to carry on. Well, what happens if that all of a sudden isn't okay, right? What happens if there isn't anyone to ever check your research? What happens if you're found in violation of the terms of the grant or the contract, right? So those are the complicated things that have caused people to be cautious. And those are the people who got money back. Those are the ones who actually won their cases, and the federal government has transferred the cash to the university. Now some of them are in the process of using those funds, only to, you know, have a question mark of like, all right, well, I'm not getting any progress reports, so what's the next step? Or, you know, we finished this phase of the research, and we're supposed to meet with you and talk about what the next phase is. Well, that's not there. Or folks are trying to finish up and close out projects, and there's no one to actually officially close it out, right? So the project stays in limbo. And so those are just some of the ways on the archaeology side that we're being impacted. But of course, the bigger labs, you know, the big science ones, the ones that have contracts with the Department of Defense, Department of Energy and stuff, that stuff is definitely more precarious, because these smaller ones like that archaeology get, we only have to make periodic statements and check in with our project sponsors. But those large ones, the multi-billion dollar ones, the hundreds of million dollar with the Department of Energy to develop all these different sciences, technology, all this different stuff, those have actual dedicated account like agents with the university. And they have accountants that work specifically with that lab and with that research group. And they also, on the other side, on the Department of Energy or whatever else, those guys have accountants too. And so once again, that's an even, you know, you can imagine the problems magnified by 100. If I can't check in on my small grant, you can imagine if I had a $1.3 billion Department of Energy grant and an entire lab running without knowing if we're doing the right thing, right? Without knowing whether I'm going to have hundreds of millions of dollars of mistaken effort, or whether they're going to say that, you know, that labor shouldn't have been compensated, and now the university needs to pay hundreds of millions of dollars to the federal government because they misappropriated the funds, right? You can see how this gets much more complicated with the bigger labs.
So I probably should have started out with this, but I want to just kind of give a little background, because maybe not everybody really knows what the furlough means and how, you know, what is a furlough. So the furloughs right now, won't go into why it's happening, but unless we have time later on, but basically how it impacts workers, federal workers, or those that are considered non-essential will be basically told to go home. They're not working. They're not fired. They're just not working. They're put on hold. And then those that are considered essential are working, but they're not getting paid. So that's created some issues for, if you've heard in the news, like air traffic controllers. And so what are the positions that are impacted? Those are the positions that are funded by annual appropriations that have lapsed. So if there's still funding, there's still money in the appropriations to fund that specific role, then they are going to be paid until those lapse. That's my understanding. And so some, let's just look at some of the agencies. It'd be agency staff and the Environmental Protection Agency, the Department of Education, NASA. Those, most of them are being put on hold. They're not working. There's some essential roles that might be working, but without pay. But for the most part, quite a few of the National Park Service staff are have been told to stay at home. I've worked, you know, I work with civilian staff. Like we have a few projects on military bases. And on military bases, you have archaeologists that many times are civilian staff, and they are not considered essential, so they're not working. And then you have, so who, you know, what entities are being impacted? That's the national parks and museums. So I believe the Smithsonian is right now closed. Some other museums are closed. Research activities, which many times are funded through or funneled through universities. And that's specifically what Bill is talking about. You have business loans. So business loans that are, you know, funded through, you know, federal funds like HUD or Small Business Administration, or even some projects, and we can talk about this a little bit more for CRM, projects that are funded through federal grants. Those are put on hold, and then inspections. So state historic preservation officers, and we could talk, kind of go into this a little bit more, but I wanted to just kind of give a rundown so that people know what furloughs are and how they're impacted. And it's not as soon as the government shutdown is done, doesn't mean everybody, boom, we go right back to where we were before. Obviously, there's some catch up, right? But I'm going to stop there and let somebody else, looks like Bill has something to say, and then we can start, you know, talking about, I think, specifically for the two groups that are on this call, how this impacts university and how this impacts CRM.
Yeah, I just wanted to add in here that this is not the way it is in most countries. This is a unique phenomenon to the United States because, you know, in a lot of other countries, if the government can't come to an agreement on the budget, then it can do things like trigger a vote of no confidence in the government and cause like a new election, or ask for, you know, individuals who are entrenched to step down because they can't actually do their job. So, you know, the reason why we have these things, my father worked for the government for a long time, and I remember him getting furloughed and laid off during other kinds of political shenanigans. It's because the folks that are in the government, specifically at the federal government, the federal level, they don't know how to do their jobs the same way that normal Americans do, right? And they still get paid even though they're not doing their job, right? So the reason why they can't figure out how to pay their bills, which it's the first or second, you know, we all just paid our bills. We all figured out how to open up our account and pay our stuff, but they don't work by the same rules, right? And that's why we don't have a government that's open right now.
Right. And some of this, you know, obviously it's because people are using this for political leverage, right? And so two ways this could be opened up is if we get a new appropriations bill, but another is a continuing resolution. And what that means, it's temporary, and that allows the funds to keep moving to the areas that the federal government funds while they get through the process of getting a new appropriations bill. So neither one of those are happening right now, which is why we are in the position we're in. So with that, we'll go on to segment two. We'll be right back. Welcome back to CRM Archaeology Podcast. Today, we're talking about the furloughs that are impacting and how they're impacting archaeology, both on the university side and with CRM. Bill gave us some really good insight on how it's impacting students and research. We'll probably talk a little bit more about that later. But for now, let's talk about CRM and how this is impacting CRM. So, you know, I mentioned earlier, there are some, you know, loans for the most part for CRM. I would say there's two areas that those of us in the business are going to be impacted by the furloughs. Number one, the SHPOs and reviews. And then the second is our clients and how the projects that they have and how they're funded. So for instance, solar projects, I'm just off the top of my head, one example is solar projects. Solar projects, some of them, you know, our clients are dependent on what they call a REAP grant through USDA. So those actually, they were on hold since the beginning of this year when the current administration came into office, and they put everything on hold while they checked different areas of funding. And so the REAP grants, for instance, have been on hold. So, you know, some of our clients had put in applications before, I think it was back. So they do these in the quarters, the fiscal quarters. And so they had, you know, put in their application and they were being reviewed. But as soon as the current administration went into office, all that got held up. It was put on, you know, a stay. And so it doesn't mean that they're not going to get the funding. It just means that review process has been stopped and there is no funding that is happening. So once everything gets lifted, now the furloughs are impacting that too. Once everything gets lifted, then everything will go back. They are also, the other thing is they are not accepting applications. So the last applications, I believe, went in November, and no more applications are being accepted until all of this clears up. So those that got their applications in earlier, before all this happened, are good, but no, there's no other applications going in. So how does that impact CRM? Because you're not going to have, you know, a lot of our clients are dependent on this type of funding, and they're looking at their cost benefit analysis on future projects, and they're not going to have that funding. They may not be going after as many projects. They may go after projects, but maybe not as many of them. So that obviously then diminishes the amount of work that is out there for CRM companies to acquire. So that's one thing. Renee, do you have any thoughts? Any areas that you're noticing are being impacted in CRM?
For me, I currently work with a lot of high profile clients, but they are, all my projects are on private land. So they have very deep pockets. So they just want the work done. But we have to let them know, like when it comes to reporting or anything like that, there's no turnaround because the SHPO off, we can't get it. Like, so it's that, but we work across multiple states. So currently we have a project in New Mexico that is indefinite not working because it's federally funded and we can't do anything about it. So we have a lot of people out of work right now. So we're trying to finagle everything. We're seeing impacts even in the private section of what I'm doing. It's just like, I can't turn around a report because you're not going to get it back on time. But we still have, like, we're still doing our field work. We can do the reporting. It just there's no turnaround on it. We have to be very upfront with them on that. And they understand mostly, but it's difficult because now our work is really, it's diminishing, right? And we're towards the end of the quarter and it's like, oh, we want all this in, but I'm like, I can't give you the product that you want because the government and SHPO and they can't do their job because they're on furlough. So the turnaround it's been tough.
Yeah, I think some SHPO offices are maybe impacted more than others. I've noticed, you know, we work in lots of states across the country. Some are being impacted and some are actually turning around their reviews in the same amount of time. So there hasn't been a glitch in that. But of course, we're only a month into the furloughs. Hopefully it ends, but so maybe that will change. I think that, you know, even private, you know, these solar projects, for instance, that I was talking about, those are privately funded, but they're also, you know, sometimes they're funded through grants and it's not that they don't have the funds, but, you know, they're businesses and why not take advantage of grants? And so their whole business model is based on a combination of different types of funds. And so, you know, if it means they know that this is temporary and then it will pick back up, these projects will go on hold. And so what does that mean for CRM? That means that maybe they're not happening right now, but as soon as everything frees up, then it's going to be like all of the clients are going to want the work done immediately. So we're going to go from having, you know, kind of a little bit of a slow period. And so that's, you know, it's hope for those that are, especially for those technicians that are really dependent on the amount of work that a company has and the amount of field work a company has. So I think that's one thing also is for those that are, maybe they have a downturn in work, I would expect that when all this clears through, you're going to end up with a lot of work is going to be piled up, and clients are going to need things happening very quickly. So, you know, that I think that's hopeful to a degree. You know, as far as SHPOs go, I think that people don't truly understand how SHPOs are funded. So they are funded by a federal mandate and through, you know, mainly agencies like the NPS. And although they are funded federally, the SHPO office, the State Historic Preservation Officer themselves are appointed by the governor. And then all the staff that is under that SHPO and in the office are paid through those federal funds for the most part. So I think it depends on the amount of money that each state has. And that's why I think each state has a different reaction, or, you know, as far as whether or not their reviews are slowed down. And so, you know, I was curious about how they're funded and how they get, and I looked this up before, but I had forgotten about it. I think we actually have even talked about it. And it would be really interesting to get a State Historic Preservation Officer on, or somebody who works for the office, for one of the offices. We've had Spencer Pelton from Wyoming on before. It would be great to chat with them and really get an in-depth understanding of the funding and how people are hired. It would be interesting. But I did look up, did a little digging, and found out that the awards that are given, the federal awards, are based on a formula of three tiers. The first tier is the base award. So they're all given a base amount. They're all given the equal base amount. And according to NPS, in 2023, the base amount for each SHPO was $400,000. And then there's tier two. And that is based on, that funding is based on the state's share of the U.S. population, the total land area, and the number of residential structures that are over 50 years old, which is really interesting to me, because I think strategically that would mean that it would behoove SHPOs to have as many of those structures documented as possible. And I am interested to find out, is that just residential structures over 50 years old, or are those eligible for listing that are over 50 years old? I don't know. I didn't do enough digging to really see what, I couldn't find that answer. But I think that's interesting because you have, let's say you have a state like California. I don't know. I would think they probably have one of the higher awards, right? Because they have both. They have a huge amount of land mass, and then they also have a very large population. And then, but then you have, let's say, a state like Wyoming, which has, you know, a considerable amount of land mass, but their population is relatively small. So, and also the development of their land is relatively slow. So I would think that the amount of residential structures that are over 50 years would be considerably less because they have quite a bit of land that's undeveloped. So their award would be less, I would think. And then you have your tier three, which is the remaining funds are allocated using the same calculations as tier two. So again, certain states are going to get quite a bit more than others. And so maybe that explains why you have different states that have a different reaction.
Yeah, you mentioned before about there being a backlog of stuff. I wonder how much of this is going to impact efforts to push against historic preservation. Because the other thing that we were going to talk about was the hearing on Section 106 that was held on the 29th of October by the Committee on Energy and Natural Resources. And in that one, I thought it was really interesting. We can talk more about it. But one of the biggest things that they were, that the folks who were kind of pushing against Section 106 were saying, is that it causes delays. And I can see how if something's delayed and it's November in Colorado and then it's got to happen, I don't know how much time you have left before the snow comes before you can even do your project. And so I can see how then they're going to freak out, not out, you know, connecting it to the government shutdown, but then be like, well, all these rules are stopping me from doing my thing. And I always think that's crazy because I live in this world where, like, just simply opting out of an app is an, you know, horrible situation, but no one in the government is screaming about that. But if they can't, you know, do any of their tiny things or it's delayed in any way, they just look for another scapegoat rather than them not getting their shit together fast enough and coordinating with the other agencies to do the project, right? So I wonder if these backlogs, you know, they'll say, okay, now money's going to flow so you can go ahead and do it. And then they find out that every CRM company is full with all the other projects they have, and then they freak out. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think so. Boy, that's a multifaceted question. But for me, there's a lot blamed on SHPO. I think that is unfair. I think SHPOs, it depends, not all, you know, they're all different. But I think a lot of times SHPOs, I've been shocked in the last year and a half when I started the practice for the company I work for now. And we've expanded into more than half the states in the U.S. And so that's given me an opportunity to work with all these different state, you know, SHPO offices. And it's shocking to me really how quickly they do turn around things. I don't know how many projects they have that are coming across their desk, but quite a few of them do stick with the 30 days. They are, and earlier sometimes. They're very responsive. They, for the most part, you have at least one person who's pretty responsive in each office. That at least that's been my experience. And so I don't think where I've seen the backlog is in the other federal governments, like in the funding in the USDA. And also, it's not just SHPO. You have, let's say we're working with the Army Corps, right? So you have all these other hoops that you have to jump through for a project that all of them have to be ordered in a certain way. And if any one of those get held up, because for whatever reason, obviously it can create a significant delay. So
yeah,
I think it's that there are so many different hands in the pot. That is the issue, more than just the expediency of, let's say, SHPO. I think SHPOs do a great job. I really do.
Yeah. And also cultural resources folks, man, because time is money. So we get it done like whatever the allocated time, and sometimes even beforehand. But it is that coordination between not just agencies, different agencies, and not just only about historic preservation, but a lot of times amongst the developer itself. Like they've got these sprawling departments that don't even actually know what's going on. And, you know, they'll start sending emails and trying to ask for things or try to ask for additional stuff over another department, right? If you work for a large company that's in multiple states and countries and stuff, sometimes you can get people from some far directorate way out there asking a question about something and they can't get the resolution. And like you're slowing down because they don't know how to coordinate their own company. Right. So yeah, I agree. I think the SHPOs get it turned around. The CRM companies I know get it turned around. And that a lot of times we're blamed for like inefficiencies in the overall system.
Right. And I think I do have something to say about that, about the CRM, but let's take this to the third segment. We'll be right back. Welcome back to CRM Archaeology Podcast. Today we're talking about the federal furloughs and the impact on archaeology, both university and CRM. So let's talk about, you know, I think we've done enough ranting about why this is an issue. Let's start talking about what are some coping mechanisms that we're using to get through the furloughs. And I think it's funny because these happen, like I can't remember exactly the last time this happened and how long it was. I do remember one that occurred back in, oh my goodness, the early 2000s. That was so crazy because I knew people that were not getting paid for a long period of time. It was tough. And you had people that were taking out loans at banks. And but it's funny how these things happen and then the furlough's over. And then we all go back to trying to fix, you know, what happened during the furlough and getting ourselves back on track. And, you know, I'm sure there's people that are smarter than me that actually you know, have written down notes and figured out, okay, next time we have a furlough, we're going to do this, right? But a lot of us just are trying to get by. We're trying to get the stuff done for our clients. We're not really looking at, you know, how can we do this better next time this happens? Because the, you know, the amount of time that goes on between the two is long enough that we don't, you know, we don't have a system in place. But I'm curious, Bill, and Andrew, from the university perspective, what are some coping mechanisms you guys are using?
Oh, man. I will say it's intrinsically difficult. And I thought on the first segment, Bill did an excellent job of describing how money works at the university level. I thought that was perfect. Like
I got to learn how to get it out of the university. Yeah. I can get it into it. I just don't know how to get it out.
No, but that's the whole, like, nobody understands that. Like, if anyone wants to know how does money work in terms of grants and stuff in the university, listen to that, like, first 5 minutes of Bill talk about that. Because I was sitting there going, yeah, exactly, right? So at the community college, I don't have to worry about that so much. But I also work as a researcher at UC Santa Barbara. And there, it's the complete opposite of the community college, right? There, I just work with other researchers, not even professors, right? These are people at the university level who are purely research. So they're working purely off grants. And what I noticed is, like, week by week, it's like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, where, like, oh, one guy just doesn't have a grant anymore.
Yeah.
You know, like, you're like, oh, yeah. No. And yeah, one totally. Guy's just, yeah, you know, they're just erased. But then, Bill, as you were saying, like a month or two will go by and you're like, phew, thank God they got money back. And we have to remember a lot of this stuff is NSF, right? I don't know if we've said the actual, like, it's an NSF grant, National Science Foundation. So so of course, since it's a government entity, with the shutdown, that is all thrown into, you know, out of whack. And on top of it, certain grants just get canceled depending on what they're about. You don't know. Yeah. So it's really a time of, like Bill was saying, it's like every week you go into the office that specializes in the giving the money out and you just kind of hope. It's like you're on the dole during the Depression and you just hope that there's like money that week. You can't tell.
What's ridiculous is, you know, like on Friday that it shows in your account there is money there and it still exists, and then you show up on Monday and the money still shows like it's in there, and then your student is like, I never got paid,
right?
You're like, wait a minute, what do you mean you never got paid? And you start going through this wacky web of ridiculosity to find out that they, like, somewhere along the line there was some kind of memo that you never got that's like, you know, we're not going to pay any money out of this NSF nothing. And you're just shaking your head like, what? Well, wait a minute.
But
like,
it's there.
Shows there's money's there. Well, we're not paying it
but
out,
it's
though.
Not.
Yeah.
This is the key. This is one thing that it's like kicking the can down the road. This, whenever you have these types of issues, and it, even with the SHPO review, right? If somebody isn't doing their job, they blame the other entity, right?
So,
right. And it's just kicking the can down the road where I'm not doing my job, but I have an easy scapegoat here. I'm just going to blame SHPO. And I know, like, we say SHP CRM, you said, and you're giving the benefit of the doubt. You're saying CRM companies do, you know, they get it done on time. That's not true. There are some SHPO, quite a few SHPO, quite a few CRM companies that don't do that. And they blame the SHPOs for it, which is so unfair. And I do think that is, and it's also a lack of sophistication with some CRM. So you have a lot of CRM companies are small mom and pop, and they're taking in maybe more than they should. And so it's an easy scapegoat to just say they haven't heard from the state historic preservation officer, because there are some states that have systems where the owner can be brought into the process. And so there's an online system and they can actually see when the report was submitted. They can see at what stage of the process that is occurring. But not all states have that. Like, California does not have that, but other states do. And so you have the clients that actually can watch the process go, and then other clients that can't. And so they're just kind of in the dark and they're reliant on the CRM professional to tell them where they're at. And that lack of transparency can create a temptation for CRM professionals to blame these federal agencies unfairly. And so that doesn't help when you get this perception with the clients that actually trust what they're being told by the CRM people. And they're saying, okay, well, then it's the SHPO's office's fault and they're being blamed unfairly. But I'm curious, back to the funding. Are all the funding, like the NSF grants, anything going through the university, is it all on a quarterly basis? Or is it like the fiscal
depends.
Quarters?
Yeah.
Or I like mine lump sum, dude. I'm like, give it all to me now. I don't want quarter nothing because I don't know what's going to happen 90 days from now with this. You know, the folks. Like, I can't know what's going to happen. Yeah. So give it all to me now.
Do it like yearly and then doled out. Okay. You know, by the month or whatever. Oh, I will say, in terms of blaming people, I feel really bad for the people who work on the money, like in the UC system, because I know some of them and they're working hard. It is the fault, I would say, for NSF at the federal level, because the people at the UC are getting blamed for all this. It lands on their head and they're like, you don't understand. We're trying to turn the pipe on for your money and no water's coming out.
I know. Yeah.
It's not them.
And they're like in the thing, like in the Millennium Falcon, like with screwdrivers and stuff trying to get it going, you know, and we're like, dude, we got to get out of here. We got to keep going. Dude, and they're like, they're in there working on the machine while it's flying, like trying to get it to happen.
I have so much respect for some of those guys. I've seen them with the wrench in the Millennium Falcon. I'm like, oh my God.
And also sometimes you get like, it's easy to think that the absurdity of the university system is the problem. But there's people who are pouring their hearts out to make sure that you're getting your funding and that this is happening. Right. And that they're like, you know, making calls and keeping abreast of every memo and everything.
Right. Every
email. Trying their best, right?
The one other arena of this I've noticed at the community college level is SNAP, right? It's like government assistance for food. And we have to realize how many students use SNAP. And it's always, even though I know it, it's always shocking to me. I'm like, man, there's so many people in need of food. And that's it like chokes me up. Like it's, you know, it's so sad and so important. And that's going to be a major thing, you know, as that falls apart.
It is good to keep that in mind because there are a lot of food. I mean, in California, man, there's kids that are living in their car. I mean, I shouldn't even say kids, like adults that are living in their cars and students who are renting out the driveway in the living room so that people have shelter and a place to wash their bodies and stuff to go to school. So food is a lot of times like second after shelter. And if there's not enough money left over, like students are hungry. And so it is, the university has put more, at least the UCs have put more money into the food bank, which already was, you know, used widely. And, you know, tragically, I would have to say there's probably postdocs and other folks that just got all their stuff canceled that are going to have to figure out. And in the case of postdocs and lecturers, like that's even more tragic because that's someone who did everything they were supposed to from the time they were 5 years old, got a PhD, is doing the dirty work of academia, and they don't even have any food for their family or for themselves. Like that's even more. Yeah, students are hoping that things will get better, but for postdocs, like they're just trying to do the job. Like they're trying to do that research and knowledge work. And when they're going to the food bank, that's what's even more, you know, that makes you, it just hurts.
When I was in university, you know, I was a single mom and I had two kids. And I think, you know, the one thing that I noticed at university is that there's not a good education with where the funding is coming from for food banks, where some of the, you know, the free systems in place are, not only how to use them, but when you should use them. So the one thing that I noticed, and we're a little off topic here, but I do think it's relevant since we brought it up.
It's government shutdown.
The one thing that I would like, just a, like, I don't know, public service announcement or something is if there's a program, and the reason I know this probably more in depth than most would be because I worked in the housing department. I ran the family and the faculty housing, and there were these free programs for free food. And you had people that really needed it. And then you had others that would just come because it was free and they really didn't need it. And I think that, to me, that's where some more education needs to occur, because if people see that something is free, they look at it and they're like, okay, well, I've paid for to be at this university. I'm just going to go and take advantage of it. And I'm going to go and get the free stuff. Right. But you may not need it. And I think that is part of the problem.
It's also relative. Like need is relative.
Yeah.
Right. No, I understand. But I don't even mind like, that. But be honest, well, because the funding is not indefinite, like it's finite funding. And that was one thing. Like, I couldn't turn people away when we were giving out food, but I knew that person was driving a Mercedes. I'm not kidding. They were driving a Mercedes. They were coming in for the free food. And that is something that it's not like, don't put me in the position to say, really, should you be here? But let's have a little bit more education as to when, who should be using the free food.
That's one approach, but another approach is just to make sure that folks have food. If that person has a BMW and they made yet another horrible deal and they're paying $1,500 a month on that thing and don't have enough money for anything, they're living in the BMW, they can't get out of it because they have negative equity and they have no credit. That person looks like they have cash, but they are drowning and they're 19. That could totally be a reality.
Absolutely. You're absolutely correct. But then that's when education needs to come in, financial education. And when people are getting their, and we've talked about this before, but when they're getting, you know, their funding, they get a scholarship or they get, people do not understand money. I don't know how old Renee is, but Bill and Andrew.
She's 89 years old, just so you know.
we're old enough.
And a lot of times she tows a Tesla to charge her other Tesla. Yeah. So she knows about money. She's good.
When we were in high school, we were taught how to handle budgets. We were taught how to, you know, we had these business classes, right? So we understood. At least it was a cursory understanding, but at least we were being taught financial responsibility, individual financial responsibility, and students are not being taught that. And so they get themselves into bad situations where they get funding, a scholarship, or they get a grant and they go and they spend money on a new car because they deserve it, quote unquote. And then I get it, Heather,
but like we were all from the 1900s, man. Like it's a different universe now. Like the numbers that these kids are facing are totally different. And the lack of like financial knowledge of their parents is even different, right? Like it's just not, I don't know. There's just a lot of horses to trick them.
I have hope that we can educate, that we can turn that around.
When it comes to food, I don't care. I don't care if there's a bit of corruption. I don't care if like 17 rich people take some food too. I don't care. I think how much corruption and graft there is on the upper end. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
in government,
it's gross.
And business.
The reason why
that.
We're starving at the bottom is because the people at the top are gorging themselves, right? That's
exactly. So a little extra money on free food, I could give a damn. I think it's fine. I get what you're saying, Heather, but like overall, I'm like, it's all right.
My question is like, how is the university system going to adjust when they can't know they're going to get the money, right? Because like, here's what I can foresee the big schools doing to try to like sidestep coming out of the endowment, right? Because they're trying to come for their endowment saying like, oh, you guys are just sitting on all this money. And I'm just shaking my head like, yeah, those schools invented hedge funds, bro. Like those people, they get those degrees, then they go out and do it. Then they come back to the university and do it there, right? So that's how they have those endowments, right? It's not because somehow the state of Massachusetts gave Harvard billions, you know what I'm saying? Trillions. It's because they hustled and cheated and scammed their way up there, right? Just like every other university. So if you build your endowment bigger to cover the precariousness of the actual grants, right, to try to replace them, it's only just more Wall Street Ponzi money anyway. So they could probably develop that way. But if you do that, then your endowment gets bigger and you're a bigger target, where an alternative could be some other side kind of that just buys futures of you getting grant money and then gives the money to the university in advance as, you know, compensation, right? So like the company is some kind of like speculative organization that bets on professors getting grants, and then it issues money to the university. And if you get the grant, then they get it back. And so you get it back with interest. And so you get fronted the cash, and then they force us to write grants and come up with the money. And that donation comes as just a straight donation. It's not off the endowment. It's just cash, right? So that could be some other gross technique that develops to try to get around the fact that the government doesn't know how to pay its bills, like you were saying, Heather, or do that simple math and, you know, finances that we all learned in the 90s.
Right.
Can I circle back to the question of the coping mechanism, what I'm coping with? Since I have a lot of friends that are in like the federal sector, like BLM, Forest Service or whatever, and I feel so guilty because I'm blessed with a job that I get paid and I'm cool, like I'm fine. I've reached out to them and asked if they need anything because I'm a giver and I want to make sure they're okay. If you have friends in those sections, I encourage you to reach out and ask if they're okay. Ask them if you could cook them dinner if you're close enough, or send them food or whatever, because they're not okay right now. They are not okay. So that's how I'm coping to make myself feel better. But they're my friends, but I always make them, like, I make sure they feel good regardless. But just reach out to your federal friends and see if they're okay, because I know they're not.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Yeah,
I love that, Renee. And I think another is, if they are allowed, you know, for those CRM companies that do have work or CRM practices within larger engineering firms that have work and they're allowed to do it, give them some work, like take them on as an as needed employee and give them work. You know, that's another, now I don't know what kind of controls there are across the board on how they can work, but I can't imagine that the government's going to tell them they can't. So that's, you know, that's a good way of helping people out, is just giving them an as needed position for the time being. So with that, we give our well wishes to everybody out there that are impacted by these furloughs more so than we are. We wish you well, and certainly reach out if you guys have any perspectives we didn't cover here, or if you have any ideas of how we can help. So with that, we appreciate you listening and we'll see you next time. Goodbye.
Take care.
See you guys next time.
Stay safe out there.
That's it for another episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for this podcast, which can be found at www.arcpodnet.com/CRMArcPodcast. Please comment and share anywhere you see the show. If you'd like us to answer a question on a future episode, email us. Use the contact form on the website, or just email chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Support the show and the network at arcpodnet.com/members. Get some swag and extra content while you're there. Send us show suggestions and interview suggestions. We want this to be a resource for field technicians everywhere, and we want to know what you want to know about. Thanks to everyone for joining me this week. Thanks also to the listeners for tuning in, and we'll see you in the field. The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.